On a snowy night in February 1972, legendary jazz trumpeter Lee Morgan, whose solo career followed stints with Dizzy Gillespie and Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, was shot dead by Helen Moore, his common-law wife, during a gig at a New York City jazz club. The murder sent shockwaves through the jazz community, and the memory of the event still haunts people who knew the couple. Casper Collins' new documentary, I Called Him Morgan, draws together a wealth of archival footage and photographs, interviews with friends and bandmates, and incredible music to tell the ill-fated pair's story. In his review in today's New York Times, A.O. Scott calls it a delicate human drama about love, ambition, and the glories of music. It opens tonight at Film Society at Lincoln Center, and I'm very pleased to welcome its director, Casper Collins, to our show, along with a pair of fabulous bassists who work with Lee Morgan, Larry Ridley, and Paul West. Welcome all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Casper, Helen served time for the crime, and following her release, she kind of retreated into obscurity. Then 20 years later, a chance encounter led her to give a remarkable interview. How did you discover the existence of those interview tapes?
Yeah, I mean, that was an incredibly important discovery in this project. I mean, I would say the first, I got into this project because of my love for this music.
So you were already planning to make a movie about Lee Morgan when you discovered them?
Yeah, because I actually saw or listened to a fantastic clip with Lee Morgan playing at YouTube with the tune called That Dare, and it was with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers in Japan in Tokyo in 1961, and it was Lee Morgan's solo there that just touched me, and that was a knockout for me. And from there, I realized that there might be a film there. But this recording I found pretty early in the research, and it was, I actually Googled then, it was in 2009, and this guy named Larry Rennie Thomas, he had a website, a blog, and you could read just parts of this interview, and it sounded very fascinating. And he sent me this CD of the tape he had made. And it wasn't just, I mean, the story this woman was telling, but also the way she was telling it and the sound of her voice, and very fascinating document, yeah.
And he recorded it. He was a radio host in Wilmington, North Carolina, and an adult education instructor. He recorded just a month before she died. But you use it throughout the film. Could you really have told the story as well as you do if you hadn't had that interview?
No, and I mean, that's a very important thing when you make documentaries, is that, I mean, the research part is very important. So you don't know from the beginning if it's going to be a film or not, but there are several things that leads up to what is the film finally. And I remember when having this document, this cassette, I didn't really know what to do with it from the beginning, but I edited it down to, I think it was 11 scenes, and it's pretty much those scenes that we have in the film right now, yes.
Paul, can you recall the first time you met Lee Morgan?
Yes. Lee Morgan and I were the two babies in Dizzy Gillespie's big band of 1956.
He was a teenager when
he was 19, and I was 22.
And how would you describe his playing at that time? Was it already mature?
It was on the way to greater maturity. He was a very seasoned, very intelligent, very knowledgeable musician.
Larry, in the film, the great saxophonist Wayne Shorter says that Lee Morgan knew how to tell a story musically. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, it's in talking about his compositional ability as he's improvising, that most of the great players, you know, when you listen to their solos become... You know, there have been people who have made a career out of even imitating or emulating their solos. So it's about being a storyteller. And, you know, and most of the great players, when you hear them solo, that's what you come away with, something that's very compositionally structured but not forced, you know, but it's just that having that kind of self-presence and self-consciousness about being able to just express yourself and not be rambling.
Paul met him with the Dizzy Gillespie Big Band. How did you first meet Lee Morgan?
Well, I came to New York first in 1959 from my hometown of Indianapolis, Indiana. And Freddie Hubbard, James Spaulding, Slide Hampton, myself, we were some of the guys. David Baker came out of Indianapolis. And it was...
Not a bad group.
No, not a bad group at all. And you know, it's just a matter of getting involved on the scene. And I came to New York with a gig, which was great, because I was playing in Indianapolis and Sly came through, and he and Freddie, and they said, hey, come on to New York and join my group. And I met Sly's octet in Pittsburgh and moved.
Well, good bass players always get work, don't they?
We try to.
Although they rarely wind up leading their own groups. Only a few of the best, Charlie Mingus and a few others, have actually had their own groups. But you play with everybody. I'm asking both of you this. How long after you knew Lee did you meet Helen? She had created a community of jazz musicians in her apartment on 53rd Street, not far from the original Birdland. Did either of you attend those parties?
No, I didn't.
No, I didn't either, but I met them under other circumstances, you know, because like, I was performing with Lee and his group, and we were doing things and hanging out at Slugs and some of the other clubs, that, you know, in Birdland and all the jazz clubs that were on the scene, the Village Vanguard, you know.
Helen was a decade older than Lee. Casper, what effect did that have on their relationship?
That is, of course, difficult to speculate, man. But I mean,
but she was kind of like both a lover, a wife, and a mother.
Yeah, if we put it like this, I mean, Helen was very special in that way, that she had her first child when she was 13 and the second when she was 14 down in North Carolina, and left them behind and moved to New York to create her own a new life. And she managed with that in New York and actually became Lee Morgan's manager finally. And her sons, they had never met their mother, and they went to New York and met her when they were in like their early 20s, and they were in the same age as Lee. when Helen was like 35 and Lee was 13 years younger, and her sons were in the same age. So that gives a perspective on the relationship, I think.
This is a kind of a sadly familiar story in jazz. Lee was battling addiction, but he was still making great music, and actually in this case she helped him get his life together. But wasn't heroin addiction a serious problem with the preceding generation of jazz physicians, less so during Lee Morgan's years? Paul?
Well, it was very prevalent.
Even then.
Mm-hmm. However, musicians beginning in the 60s and 70s began to come to the conclusion that that wasn't the way to go. And it wasn't absolutely necessary to advance as a musician by doing that.
Did you know that he was an addict?
Oh, surely. Mm-hmm. Sure, I knew him, and especially just prior to 1969, when I became director of Jazzmobile, I started a jazz workshop there, which I wanted to try and attempt to create like a jazz institution similar to Berkeley. And I thought about Lee and how, knowing his condition, and knowing his weaknesses, needed some kind of situation that would give him some stimulation, some motivation, some a sense of worthiness and worthwhileness. And I thought that let me bring him in as an instructor. Mm. And he and Kenny Durham became two of my trumpet player instructors. And that's when I became more familiar with his wife.
Well, how was Helen able to get him into treatment when so many others who tried weren't?
Well,
go ahead. Any one of you, it's okay.
Well, Helen had a very maternal relationship with Lee. And she actually almost physically and literally picked him off the gutter from behind the Apollo Theater when he was really in his addiction stages and brought him to life.
One of the themes in the film, Casper, is weather. And the shooting occurred during a blizzard. But you create a sense of foreboding by using weather throughout the film. And didn't Lee say on New Year's Day of 1972, that something drastic is about to happen? I can just feel it. Another sense of foreboding. That was just a month before he was killed.
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, for me, there is, I mean, the film is navigating towards this unavoidable ending, tragic ending of Lee's life, where the woman that actually saved him also is the one that shot him at this club, this snowy night. And that snow, that was, I think, one of the first visual ideas I had for this film. And I was living, I'm a Swedish filmmaker, but I was living in New York 2010, 2011, and had a chance to wait for those great blizzards to come in. And we did. We did.
I imagine there were some serious blizzards in Sweden as well.
Yeah, that was funny because, you know, I'm very used to snow, but this was a lot of snow.
My guest is Casper Collin, who is the director of this new film that opens today called I Called Him Morgan. It's at the Film Forum at Lincoln Center. Also, two of jazz's finest bassists, Larry Ridley and Paul West. Larry, could you describe Slug Saloon in the East Village, the site of Lee's last gig?
Well, Slug's was a very interesting club because it was down in the meatpacking district, which, and in the evenings, you know, when everything closed down, you know, we can be out in front of the club or just hanging out and talking loud or whatever, you know, just having a good time. And the night that this happened, because I worked in Slugs a lot with different groups, and I was on my way down to the club that night, but it was starting to snow, and I said, "Oh my God, I don't want to get caught in the snow." So I turned around and just went back in the house. You know?
It wasn't near public transportation; you had to take a cab there. Although you don't hear much about it anymore, it was one of the leading jazz clubs at the time.
Well, that wasn't an impediment to me, you know. If I want to get somewhere, I'll get there. But it was just the fact that it was an impending blizzard, and I didn't want to be stuck in Slugs and trying to get back home, you know, that kind of thing.
Paul, you were there that night.
I was stuck in that snow. I was there.
What do you remember about that evening?
Oh, it's still, I still, like it was yesterday. My brother and his wife, and I and my lady at the time, decided to go to Slugs to hear Lee Morgan, who was one of my instructors at the time. And as soon as we walked in, Helen approached me at the door and said, "Paul, why don't you go talk to your buddy over there? Here he is with this little girl, and I'm here present. Talk to him."
So do you think that a reason for the shooting was that she felt betrayed? She'd helped him straighten his life out, given a lot of herself to him, only to have him take up with this much younger woman?
Absolutely. And not only that, but I think worse than that was the fact that just prior to his coming to the club, he and this little lady got into a car accident. And he became upset and started to drink, so that when he came on the gig, he was intoxicated. And that really infuriated her, because now, after all the work that she had put into him to help him develop and continue as this artist, he is not able to perform accurately because he's intoxicated.
And could you tell the difference when somebody was high in alcohol or on heroin?
Oh, sure, I think so.
Oh, yeah.
Larry, in the film, you described the anger you had toward Helen after the shooting. Didn't you run into her after she was released from jail?
Yes.
What was it like to see her?
Well, before I had even encountered her, I had all this stuff in my mind because, you know, Lee and I were close. We were like brothers, like Paul and all of us. You know, we had a brotherhood going on, you know. And I kept saying to myself, if I ever see this, I'm going to ream her a new, you know what. And I just had all this stuff, anger, that was pent up in me, you know, because, you know, Lee was like a brother to Paul and I both. You know, we had a brotherhood, you know, among the musicians. And when I was in Slugs, and she came from the area from where the bandstand was as I was coming in the front door, and I spotted her, and she spotted me. It was almost like a simultaneous recognition of us on both of our parts. And I was hesitant because that's, you know, I was saying all this stuff. If I, you know, I'm going to ream her anew, you know what. And as she got closer, we both just broke down, and she came and I just hugged her. And she was crying and she was saying, "Larry, you know, I didn't mean to. You know, I love Lee." And I said, I know, Helen, you know, and all the stuff, that the anger that I had that had been building and just faded.
Well, Paul, you were actually next to him.
I was five feet away.
So did you fear for your own life?
No, I didn't consider my life at all.
Could you feel sympathy for Helen
after
the shooting?
Oh, I did. In fact, about 5 o'clock in the morning after attending the leaving the emergency room and getting the confirmation that he was in fact dead, at about 5 o'clock I called the Reverend Genzel, who is the jazz minister. I called him at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I said, look, what happened? Helen had just killed Lee. She's probably incarcerated now, and she needs help. And so I felt a very ambivalent feeling about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the music still lives on.
It's true.
Casper Collin, jazz historian Gary Gidden, and our two musician guests here, Larry Ridley and Paul West, will appear for a Q&A on March 24th. That's tonight at 6 p.m. at the show at the Film Society of Lincoln Center. And then Casper Collin will also appear at the Film Society of Lincoln Center on March 25th for a Q&A for the 6 p.m. show. The film is I Called Him Morgan. And thank you so much, all of you, for being on our show.
My pleasure.
Thank you. My pleasure.